This is a very special session of the men's workshop and the first time that we have had this particular session. And if you read in your programs, it says, over a century of sobriety that says it works. And the three men, and one old goat standing back here, that he knows I love him. Between those four guys, there's more than 100 years of sobriety. Frankly, I want to know how they did it. And that's what this hour is all about, to find out how it's worked for that combined 110 or 11 years or whatever it is of sobriety. And to moderate this hour, the man that all of us who know have come to love a great deal, sometimes in spite of himself, the sponsor who takes suggestions seriously and is damn strong at making suggestions, join me once again in welcoming the daddy of this workshop, Doc Randall.
Hi, everybody. I am Doc Randall, and I am an alcoholic. By the grace of God, I'm sober tonight. This is a real privilege and an honor for me, not just because these men are in AA and have a long time sobriety, but each and every one of all three of these fellows meant an awful lot to me, particularly in the early stages of my sobriety. This could be called a session on as Bill sees it, because all three of these fellows are Bills. Billy Fristo, sitting on the end, was a member of my original home group. Some of you know Jim Pippin, the Tuesday night meeting over on Ponce de Leon. And Billy was a regular member of that group and was there when I started going to that group. Billy always enjoyed his humor. He had a way of getting his points across, and as I remember, he used a lot of horses. Did all your horses die, or? And they went to dog food. Bill Roop was a member of, we used to have a luncheon group that met downtown, another innovation of Jim Pippin's, who was my sponsor. Had a regular luncheon that we got together every day. And Bill Roop was a member of that group. I'm not real sure how long, or if it has been true or not, how long Bill has been sober. Pippin used to question his sobriety. He used to prefix when he was introduced or say anything about Bill, he would say, well, Bill says he has been sober X number of years. And, of course, Bill Hollinsworth, who is my present sponsor, was an old drinking buddy of Jim Pippin back in 100 years ago when they both lived in Macon. I used to be able to sit, I just enjoyed sitting for hours at a time listening to Bill and Jim talking about their experiences and back in Macon when they both had their nose in the sauce. But all three of these men mean a tremendous amount to me. I've moved around the country a bit. We lived up in Ohio and over in Augusta and so forth since I've been sober, and then we came back to Atlanta. And I never have been able to find, no matter how good the AA is and all these various places that we have been in, I've never been able to find people that replaced these guys that held my hand when I got here, and gave me the things that I needed. What we're going to do with this hour, each one of these fellows are only going to take about 20, 25 minutes and give you a brief synopsis of qualification of themselves and what the AA program has meant to them. We had thought about opening it up for discussion, and it was changed. Any of you that have any questions pertaining to any phase of AA, these are the three guys to get to. And after the meeting tonight, collar them and get with them and get better acquainted with them. I might warn you, though, that if you fool around with them, you just damn might stay sober. You might quit that drinking that we thought was so good. Billy Fristo, why don't you come up and lead off?
Thank you very much. I'm Bill Fristo, and I'm an alcoholic. and it's a real privilege to share in this. I didn't know when I was on the way up here with Steve that this was going to happen, but it's nice, and I'm glad to do it. It's always a privilege to share in any AA manifestation. My alcoholism broke out when I went in medical practice in 1952 in Jackson, Mississippi. That was the terminal point where the money ran out and the residency training was all over and I had to go to work. And I was supposed to be the epitome of a young, dashing young specialist, the OBGYN doctor, highly trained, supposed to be a leader in the Christian community. I was a member of the Broadview Methodist Church there. Sang in the choir one or two times. I couldn't stand up, so I sat and sang. But they thought I had a broken ankle or something, you know. I don't know. I'm supposed to be a father, an example of a father, a husband, and I couldn't cut the mustard in any of these roles. I didn't feel comfortable in any of them. I felt totally inadequate, and I had already discovered that alcohol could make me have rippling muscles, increase my body weight by about 85 pounds, and give me a chest girth of about 90 inches. Like a bull. And I weighed about 128 wet. But the great illusion was always with me when I drank alcohol. It was also with me when I took Seconal, Imbital, Doradin, or any of the other 38 drugs I used. And it was with me when I took amphetamines. It was with me when I took anything that changed the way I felt through chemical means or working on my brain. And I was a hog about all of it. Just loved it. The budding practice got nipped in the bud by the frost of alcoholism. It froze and broke off. I decided very quickly that the greatest mistake I'd ever made was to start practice that far below the Mason-Dixon line. I was from West Kentucky, and I felt that they considered me a damn Yankee, and no wonder I wasn't making it good. And so we moved to Atlanta, where I thought that I would have it made, and took my wife and two children, and we headed back to Atlanta, my wife's home. There I went in practice with another physician, and unfortunately the addiction had followed me. Now, this was the second year of the addiction. And like King Kong, she was growing. It was getting bigger and bigger. And it was beginning to bend me over a little bit under the weight of it. The situation with my wife, she was apologetic, trying to ignore what was going on, and in massive denial about what was happening to her husband. And I could understand this. And I had her believing that it was her fault that I really felt that what my great flaw was that I had married in the first place. I should have stayed single, and all this wouldn't have happened. It was a responsibility of having to be a father, a husband, all this crap that you have to be, you know. And I couldn't be it so good. I couldn't cut it. And the beat went on. It increased in fervor, if you will. And I was trying to stay in a steady state all the time, stay mellow, not get in overdosage, and not go in withdrawal. And I tried to do this around the clock. And gradually, and it got faster. It's like a snowball going downhill as the tolerance increases. And I had to have more to do the same thing I did at the beginning. The thing that was going on, I was either on a bender, getting over one, or planning one. And that consumed 100% of my time. It took all my time. I needed a caddy to follow me around and carry the different drugs that that I had to take to try to do the balancing act. And I said long ago, it's like one man ping pong. But the table, she gets longer and longer. And you serve, and ain't nobody there to make the return. It's tough. Up on, with the speed, and then down with the sedatives. And trying to stay in the middle of this was just impossible. My behavior was abominable. Abdominal. It was terrible. It stunk. I began to lose friends, alienate people, animals, anyone around. I hated everybody. I wanted to know why the world stunk. It's like the guy who passed out in the bar room, and while he was out, they painted Limburger on his upper lip. And he woke up spluttering and coughing and burping, and he ran out in the street and said, "My God, the whole world stinks." So, I really had it. I broke down in 1960. This was in the about the seventh year of the flaming addiction to alcohol and other drugs, and was sent away, carted off to a mental hospital in Towson, Maryland, up near Baltimore, and went there. As far as I know, I went for depression. And I stuck with it. That's why I'm here, depression. And buddy, I was flat pressed like a flounder. I've been on a lot of depressants. And my wife took me, she was pregnant. She usually was in those days. And I would cry on her shoulder. And she was still trying to raise me and the other kids. And it was tough. And I was in my 40s by now. And I did not turn out to be what she thought I would be at the altar, I'll tell you that. Far from it. So, stayed in Baltimore a couple of months, came home and started the same thing all over again. So this time, I started using the liquor. Like they said, the liquor's quicker, and that's correct. Instead of the drugs. But pretty soon, you can hold your breath only so long in an elevator with other doctors. And you can only, you just can't talk when you're inhaling. Can't talk. And I realized the odor was going to ruin me, and so I gave up. And I got back on the barbiturates and the speed and the other 39 things I love. And I quit drinking and thought it was a marvelous thing to do. And I was smart as hell to think of it. And I don't wonder, when I eventually did get to AA, that I had so much trouble seeing how I could be alcoholic. Hell, I didn't even drink. Didn't even drink. Now, I tried to drink, and I would do flash drunks in the afternoon. That's when you drink out of the paper bag on the way home from the office, and you drink a pint before you can turn around the corner, and you're already full of other drugs, and you're in overdose before you can turn around. And I started in the house and fell down the steps backwards, and injured myself. And decided that I didn't drink well. On Cicinal, Nemutal, Dordin, amphetamines, and 39 other drugs. I didn't drink well on that. So I decided not to drink. And the substitutes appeased me. They took care of my yearnings. And I'm going to cut into this now, because I'm taking up time with horseplay. I am really serious about the AA program. You might not think so from what you've heard so far. But I had a 21st birthday on the 4th of this month, on Monday. And friend, you don't do that with black silk threads and mirrors. I did it the hard way. I went away to two more hospitals after Baltimore. The second one being in Willowdale, Ontario, with Dr. Gordon Bell. It was a fine place. I spent a month there and didn't learn a damn thing. And insulted everyone in Canada and came home. And started the same crap again. And the next hospital was Lexington, Kentucky, USA. It was in the bluegrass. I was from Kentucky, born and raised there, and I had to go home in a way to get straightened out. Now, I'm a firm believer that getting sober and staying sober is a disciplinary experience. This whole program has been designed, as far as I'm concerned, for me to discipline myself to what kind of life I have chosen for myself, what kind of profession I chose. It has allowed me, the program, a means of living the way I wished to live back when I was drunk and couldn't and wouldn't. And they're the same thing. God provided me the means of doing this. No question about it. It wasn't my idea to get 21 years of sobriety. Not at all. I had trouble amassing 6 weeks when I first came. I would have 24 years if I had been willing to start, but I wasn't ready. I didn't want it. So I got 21, for which I'm very grateful. But like they say, when the student pupil is ready, the teacher appears. I think that's true. I came in unwilling. I wanted to argue about everything. I think something that Dr. Sam Shoemaker said some time ago, who influenced and helped shape Bill Wilson's thinking about this program and formation of this program. He said that every man is some kind of a weakling, and if he thinks he's not, then pride is his weakness, and it's the greatest weakness of all. I was one who would have had a seizure if I'd been told that early. Now I can derive a lot of insight from it. Because I thought I really had no weaknesses. I hated weaklings. I was sick a great deal when I was young. I had the St. Vitus dance, and I tap danced my way through the grade school, shaking all over, and I hated it because it was a sign of a weakness in my central nervous system. It really wasn't anything. I was just guilty as hell about beating my meat all the time. And I had a few wet dreams and thought I had cancer of the bladder or something. I don't know what that is. I was scared my mama would find out. I'd get up and wash the sheets in the middle of the night. That is a hell of a fix. So, coming to AA was for me a last resort. I came kicking and screaming. I came against my will and was mad as hell about it. I felt that I could find a way all my own. And no one seemed to appreciate my abilities. Put to mind of something Peter Marshall said about prayers. He said there's several kinds. And said one of his favorites, and said it goes like this. He said, God, take me and use me in any way you see fit, but you and I both know that I'd best be used in an executive capacity. And that's the type of guy I was. Just full of shit as a Christmas turkey. And felt truly unlovable, incapable of love or being loved. I just was dying. I couldn't believe that I could be loved. And this was damaging to me. So finally I began to make it through a traumatic and bloody experience in Lexington, shoveling shit for 4 months in the sewage disposal plant. It was a marvelous therapeutic experience, I assure you. And it cut me down to size, the size of a small turd. Just exactly. And I felt bad about that. But, be that as it may, I came out of there ready. I had read the big book there. I had delayed reading the big book for 3 years. I didn't want to know what the son of a bitch said. I already knew what I thought. And I didn't want to be confused about factual stuff. I don't like that. I know what I think. So the AA loved me enough to allow me to get my own bruises and at my own pace. But I nearly ran out of gas before I got all the bruises and pleasure that I could stand. But at last I began to buy the program, totally and completely dedicate myself to the simple practice of the principles of the program. And mostly endowed and imbued in the 12 steps and in the tradition. All of it, I love it. It's provided a way out for me when I had no way. And I came with complete acceptance to the realization that I did not have a way and that I was going to die from my addiction. And going to die untreated if I had my way. And so I ceased having my way and began to bend to God's will. There is another thing I love to say. I love to hear it. I love to say it. And that is that there's just no telling, there's no limit to how far a man can go if he don't care who gets the credit. I like that. I like the sound of that anonymous thought. And I didn't go far, by the way. I retired from the VA in January. I worked over there a little bit over 9 years in the alcohol and drug rehabilitation program. I practiced OBGYN 23 years before that, 11 drunk and 12 sober. And if you were in the first 11, that's tough shit. If you were in the last 12, you had a damn good doctor. That's the way it is. Well, that's the way she came down, as I say. So, I enjoyed that second career more, I think, than I did the first one. And it's a lucky man that can have two diversified careers, such as I've had. My wife, let me just tell you this. Ruth has been a devout Al-Anon from the very start. They took her to the first Al-Anon meeting she went to, Flossie Pippin was there. And Ruth bought it hook, line, and sinker. They told her she couldn't stop my drinking. She couldn't be responsible, was not responsible for my behavior, that I was responsible to make my own recovery, and that was that. And she bought it. And that influenced terrifically my decision and acceptance of the fact that I really would have to shoulder responsibility for both my drinking and my sobriety, both of them, and began to get it. So my wife contributed. I've been blessed in having the kind of wife I had. And you'd love her. You would love her. I love her. And there was a time when I didn't think I could. And blamed her for all my troubles. So I don't know how it works. I go to two meetings a week. I read the big book a lot. I read the 12 and 12 a lot. I think about this program all the time. And it's that simple. I have had to perforce keep it rather simple, I think. I get it very complicated very fast. And I can always find comfort within those pages of that big book. I love the program, and I love you who compose it and give it life. Without you, it's just dead ink on white papyrus. You give it life and meaning. And I don't know where I'd be without it, but I wouldn't be here tonight. Thank you.
Bill Root from Marietta.
Hi, I'm Bill Rook. I'm an alcoholic. I think one of the great benefits of the AA program is hearing guys like Christo and Hollingsworth that you're going to hear and some of the others I really enjoyed, because it's always interesting to me to get inside of another person's thought stream, what he was like, and how he came here. In my particular case, as I mentioned briefly earlier, I didn't know I was an alcoholic when I came here. And I drank a lot, and I got in a lot of problems, and some of the things that... I never got into drugs. I'd never been exposed to drugs, never in... I guess it's because I never had been around doctors. I never could afford to go to doctors. If I'd have gone to doctors, then I could become a drug addict, you know, because that's how you become one, you know. So every doctor gets up and says, I'm a drug addict, you know. So I figured, shit, stay away from doctors, you know. That's just a little information I throw out there without charge, you know. I, like Bill, have found this the greatest thing that's ever happened in my life. I'm a very blessed individual for being led to Alcoholics Anonymous. I started out also in a church, and I also had the ability to get elected to things like president of the BYPU. I was active in church functions, and up until World War II, I didn't drink. I played in sports and played basketball a lot, and drink was not anything that I had any great affinity for. I didn't immediately fall into it. And if you'd have seen me in those days, I looked, I imagine, like any red-blooded American boy. I was active in school and did quite well and got along well, had a lot of friends. But inside me, I hated me. Inside me, I was full of fears. I knew I was no good. I knew before I drank that I could not stand me. And so therefore, I always had to lie and tell you I was something else. This is before I drank. I wasn't a thief because I drank. I stole from the Baptist church when I was a kid. I stole money when I was about 9 years of age. One of the little envelopes was to the mission, and one envelope was to the church. I'd put the one in the envelope, take the nickel out of the other, go across to a candy store, buy a large bag of candy for a nickel, and give it out to my little friends. Because if I could buy your friendship, and if I could do something for you, then I knew you'd like me. So I never really want anybody to know me. This was, of course, a lot because my father had me raised by my aunt. I felt he didn't love me. My mother died when I was young. I had total rejection. I didn't know this until after I came in AA. So I felt that I didn't like my lot in life, so therefore I couldn't let you know who I was or what I was, because I knew me and I didn't like me. Now, I never verbalized this or consciously came to any conclusion. This is hindsight, but this is what I did. I felt not a part of. I never felt that I fit in. World War II came along and everybody got in the service. And that's the first time I started to drink. And I found out that drink... Well, I think this is true of all wars, but if you've ever been in a war, drink goes very well with wars. I don't think it's good to go through a war without drinking, especially if you're in combat. It's just wonderful if you drink. Because sober, it's horseshit. You know, it ain't too good if you're drinking. I came back from overseas. I did a lot of things that other guys were court-martialed for. It never happened to me. You see, I was never punished for anything I've ever done. When I go and speak at an institution, usually I've done everything they're in there for, most of the things. But God has seen fit to let me walk the streets. Until I got so sick of me, He finally led me to Alcoholics Anonymous. My problem wasn't drinking. My problem was living. My problem was life. My problem was this insecure individual that couldn't face up to the normal existence. And when I drank, it anesthetized the pain, it anesthetized the rotten things I was doing, and enabled me to live with me. I never blame my drink for anything. I'm blessed. My wife's also an alcoholic. We got married when we were 18 years of age. We didn't know we were alcoholics. She'll tell you she's got 27 years of sobriety. She's very fortunate that she came in AA. Because today, see, if I hadn't come in AA, I'd probably be in the Baptist church, and I probably would be an elder. I might even be treasurer. And I'd be stealing money, you know. I'd never tell anybody, because I never told anybody this stuff when I was drinking, you know, and I never did so. You just don't go around telling people that you're, you know, Baptists don't have any sin. You know, that's one nice thing about being a Baptist. You know, drinking's a sin, so I had to change from a Baptist. I was going to be a Catholic, because Catholics are much more realistic. They don't, drinking per se isn't a sin, only excesses of it. So I wouldn't ever get indulged in excesses, so I thought I might be a Catholic. Well, this didn't work out either. But I never thought of not drinking. I'll give you one example of I never was punished. A lot of people, a couple of my friends here today, Harrison and Capes, they're lawyers. I was a lawyer. When I was drinking, you know, I knew all the things about law, and I would share with people. And I remember one time I was coming out of Blue Island. I was been drinking for some hours there in a bar. And as I started home to Park Forest, a fellow cut me off, and he had some children in the car. And so I leaned out the window, and I suggested he was driving erratically. And I also suggested that perhaps his ancestry was in question. And I didn't like his goddamn kids either, you know. Anyway, one thing led to another after this witty interchange. And I said, why don't we call a cop? I've had enough of your shit. And he was a cop. So I was in the Blue Island Jail. And now I am screaming I'm an officer of the court incarcerated because I tried to stop mayhem on the highway. So the judge came down and he said... He released me on personal recognizance. Now I have a problem. See, I'm only a lawyer when I drink. These other guys went to law school. You know, I just got immediate degrees, you know. Sometimes I was an FBI man. Or, you know, one time I was a Baptist minister, but that just doesn't play in the bars I went to, you know. You don't get any action saying, I'm the pastor. All the broads go, you know, that's no good. Anyway, so then I had to sweat it out because here I was really an Allstate agent sitting out in the Blue Island store where anybody could see me, and I thought, oh my God, I'll get caught, he'll find out what I am. And I was the last case called that night in court, and as I approached the bench, he said, Counselor, how do you feel tonight? And I said, great, because I knew he hadn't discovered I was a liar. And I said, Your Honor, I'm sorry I conducted myself like I did in your presence, but I do think the officer shouldn't have driven it erratically. He said, well, you certainly sound good tonight. He says, why don't we dismiss the case? And he did, and I left. See, I never was punished for anything I did. Whatever role I took on, I became an actor, and I played the part well. This works well with the mafia. I could go into stories that are just almost as good as yours, you know, of the shit I pulled and got away with. See, Billy said it, and other people have said it. God loved me. The God I didn't want any part of loved me. Now, when I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, January 3rd, 1957, I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I didn't know. I can't really figure out why I came, except I was sick of myself when I woke up on the floor of a girl's house in AA. Her husband was there. I never used to mention that, and she heard me say that one time. She said, why don't you suggest and tell him my husband was there, you know. Okay, so, Mary, your husband was there, you know. But I was sick of me, and I called AA, and these guys came out, and this started the opening of the most wonderful experience of my life, an experience I never contemplated what was before me, and I certainly really wasn't looking for it. See, I was the type of guy that liked to go to bars because I felt comfortable with people who drank. I'm still comfortable with people that drank. They just aren't drinking today. I feel comfortable with this type of guy. Now, when I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, I put the cork in a jug, and I didn't take a drink. And I was the same rotten son of a bitch I was when I was drinking. The only difference was I had no anesthetic to hide it. I was married. I had 5 kids. I felt like you with responsibilities. But in addition to your responsibilities, Billy, I had won World War II single-handed. And I had saved this country from democracy, you know. And just all these wonderful things, so people didn't appreciate me. And when I came home, everybody told lies, and I certainly fit right in there. And so I came in this program, and I was exposed to a whole new way of life. You know, I'm a graduate of, I always say this because Harrison likes me to say it, I graduated from DePaul University. This is always interesting to me, maybe nobody else, but Jack used to get mad. He says, I don't like a sponsor that says you've graduated from college. That's not necessary. And I said, Jack, if I was like you in a law office with all my degrees up on the wall so they could come in and see it, I wouldn't have to say it. But I got mine up in the bathroom, and not too many people go there, you know. But at any rate, I had done very well in school. I was an honor student. I got A's in moral guidance. See, my problem was I never thought of using any of this stuff. I have never heard anything in AA that I didn't really know before I came here. But once again, I find out that people here are using it. They don't tell me that if you stay sober... They said, we stayed sober and our life got better. Maybe it'll work for you. They told me that if I didn't take one drink, my life would get better. I came in here and I thought they talked too much about not drinking, because I loved the fellowship. The people were great. But they kept talking about not drinking, and I asked why, and they said, your life will get better based on our... And that's why I came in AA. See, I didn't come here because I was so smart. I didn't come here because I knew what I was. God sent me to AA. And when I got here, I was the same rotten guy I was outside. I sat in card games this afternoon, and some people educated me a little bit on how to play cards, and I appreciate that. But when I first came in, I knew I could play cards better than everybody else. And when I saw these guys playing cards, I thought I'd supplement my income on Friday night. And I sat down in the game, and they played it so fast I couldn't figure it out, and I never won any money. But what I used to do is I'd sit down and borrow $20 to get in the game. If I won, I'd give them back 10. If I lost, I'd give them back nothing. And yet I was active starting groups. I was a very good sponsor. I sponsored a lot of guys. The group was always available. I worked with people. And after a year, it dawns on me, this isn't any way to treat your friends. And I went up to my sponsor and I said, why the hell did you guys put up with this? And they said, we had a meeting about you and you weren't costing us too much money and you were staying sober. Right? See, they loved me with unconditional love because I was an alcoholic. They didn't love me because I was going to become a wonderful person. I was just an alcoholic that wasn't taking a drink. Now, when I go to my sponsor and I say, I'm not doing anything right, I'm kiting checks, I'm doing the same thing, he'd say to me, did you have a drink today? And I say, no, I didn't have a drink. What the hell is that? He said, because if you're an alcoholic and got the disease of alcoholism, if you haven't had a drink today, you're doing what most alcoholics can't do. You're arresting your disease. You're a miracle. And he says, if you don't take a drink in any one day, you're a winner. Now, see, I was so lucky that God sent me Jack M because I was a loser when I came here. I was conditioned to failure. I was conditioned to poor self-image. I was happier with negativity. And I come here and I meet a guy that says, that's not true. You're a winner. You're not drinking. You're an alcoholic. I'm real happy I met that Jack Murray, and I've told a lot of guys that since then. Now, that's what I call my period of sobriety. I put the cork in a jug. I was the same guy I was, and I was better than when I was drinking. Sobriety is great. You see, it's funny how God works. I didn't want any part of God. Didn't want to hear about Jesus. Didn't want to hear any of that stuff. If you want to say higher power, that's AA. You know, the big book has something like 162 gods, and it's got about three higher powers. But I never read the big book, so I didn't know that. But I knew I could tell people what was in there, even though I hadn't read it. See, lack of knowledge of the topic has never deterred me from talking, you know, or giving very positive opinions. See? Now, I'll give you an example. I didn't want any part of God, so what I did is I worked with people. I 12-step people. You know what the other book says? Whatever you do for the least of me, you do for me. So really, that's where God is. He's in people. When I started working with people, I was finding God. Honestly, I'll give you one example of that in my period of sobriety. I got on the program, and they all talked about honesty as a very important thing. And after I was on the program about 2 or 3 years, I was making a 12-step call with an airline pilot who had been sober 3 years. And the airline pilot, we got the Polak back in the house. We had a lot of Polish in Chicago, lovely people, you know. And this Polish was being evicted from his house. We finally talked his wife into taking him back. And as we're sitting there in his kitchen having coffee, the airline pilot says to Henry, he says, the kids are out drinking. The men are in AA. The heroes are in AA. And he points to me, he says, for example, this guy's got the Congressional Medal of Honor. Now, I didn't have, and I don't have, and I don't contemplate getting it, but I didn't want to mention the airline pilot, because we'd have been talking about honesty, and it would have just confused the pigeon, you know, to bring it up at that time. So when I got outside, I forgot to mention it to the airline pilot. Somehow it slipped my mind. And I quit going to the meeting we used to go to. And you know, it's a funny thing. If you're brand new on the program, we tell you we're honest. We tell you this is an honest program. So if a guy's got 2 or 3 years and he says a fact, you'll accept it because we're honest. Well, a lot of these people at that meeting had heard what Tom kept saying about Roop and his Congressional Medal. And they'd come up to me and they'd say, Bill, I understand you had quite a war record. Do you want to talk about it? And I'd say, no, I'd prefer not to. And I got a reputation for being humble. You know, I not only was a hero, I was a humble hero, see? And after about 6 months, some Yankee broad comes up and she says, what's this Congressional Medal of Honor bullshit? And I said, I don't have it. But I had it for 6 months on the program. And so, see, honesty didn't come easy to me. The guy said to me at a meeting, he says, on the program, you turn over to God whatever's bothering you. I says, that's ridiculous. Not an anthropomorphic concept of a God up there. It's the God within. It's not the God without, you know, that you're reaching for. Because I knew all this. I had a lot of training in all that area. When I got done with my dissertation, the guy said to me, Roop, he says, I've been watching you. He says, you could turn your life over to the garbage man. He'd do better than you're doing. And I said, okay, you wise guy. I said, how do you work it? He says, you turn over to God whatever's bothering you. I said, hey, God, they're going to repossess the car. Hey, God, we don't have any money for the lights. Hey, God, you better get off your duck. We need food. You know what I was doing? I was praying. See, all my God wants me to do is talk to him. When I was 14 years old at Conference Point Camp in Williams Bay, Wisconsin, I became a born-again Christian. Jesus Christ entered into my life, and it became a very meaningful thing in my life. As Clancy says, through a series of bad breaks and misfortunes, I started following hedonistic pursuits, and I put down on the back bench, and it damn near killed me. I even went through an election that I was amoral. I was above morality, and it really didn't apply to me, you know. And if you'd gone through this shit, wonderful. It damn near killed me, you know. But, so I started turning things over to God, and all my God wanted me to do was pray where I was that day. 7 years later, I'm driving down the highway in an English Triumph, and all of a sudden, out of the corner of my peripheral vision, I get a glimpse of something hurtling down. I can't stop. I run into a train going 60 miles an hour. Before we hit, I said, God, it's yours. The car went over many times, and I was thrown out, and all I got was 5 stitches in my thumb. I had no shock. Park Forest is a commuting town, and a lot of people were going to work. So I was sitting, I was gathering up, and I was bleeding profusely. I had a handkerchief around, and a lot of people around. I'm gathering up my papers and putting them in my attaché case, and a cop comes up. I always had an affinity with cops. And the cop said to me, "You're in shock." And I said, "No, I've been in shock. I know what shock is." He says, "No, if you have an accident like this, you're going to shock." And I said, "Well, if I'm in shock, will you pick up the papers?" He says, "Sure." So I went into shock, and he picked up the papers. And had a cigarette. And then we started driving over to the hospital because they always examine you for 24 hours to make sure there's nothing wrong. And as we're going down Route 30 heading into Chicago Heights, I look up, we're coming to a red light. Now the cop knows he's got his little blue light or whatever color it was at that time, and he knows that everybody pays attention. Well, I never did. When I was drinking, I had impairments. I couldn't see cops or lights or what have you. Anyway, I happen to look out to the left, and here's a woman in a white Chevy, and she's got a green light. She's coming about 50 miles an hour, and I think, oh, Christ, we're going to kill each other. So I yell in his ear, "Stop!" So the cop puts on the brakes and stops. The woman in the Chevy goes right by, and the cop went into shock. And I had to drive him into the hospital, you know. So my point is that even though I wanted no part of God, I started working with people. Even though I'm turning over to God, when the chips came down, I developed a practice of God. Now, at the end of 7 years, I was brought to Atlanta, Georgia. My period of sobriety was wonderful. It's better than drinking. If you're in sobriety, God bless you. But if you want to get the benefits of this program, the steps are the way I found to do it. You've heard people talk about them, this period. The sooner you can get into the step, work in them however you can. I don't believe anybody can work a bad step. If you work the step the best of your ability at that time, that's all that's expected of you. If one of my friends, Tony D, did an inventory at Hazleton, and he was up there for 6 months, he did it with a psychiatrist. Tony says, "I explored every avenue of my character defect. There's really nothing more I've discovered, so I've only taken the fourth step once." It's great. That's Tony's story. He shares it, and it's true for Tony. That wasn't the way it was for me. I did a very poor fourth step, but I finally tried doing something. I finally took a look at Bill Roop, the guy that he hadn't looked at for years. Didn't look at him when he was sober as a kid, and I didn't look at me when I was drinking. And I finally had the guts to look a little bit, and I had to share with somebody. And then from other people, I found out what I was. So this has been a wee program for me. People have helped me. It's not my great intellect or my knowledge or my insight that got me here. My God got me here, and my God has kept me here. And you people have kept me here because I'm comfortable. I'll tell you one thing before I quit. This program, if you've been on the program a month, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, there's certain things you have to do. Friends with a person I have a great deal of respect for. Was sober 28 years, became a minister, did a wonderful job. He's up Bill Hollingsworth way. And he started retreats. He had a ministry, and he was just a wonderful AA and a great minister. He didn't drink, and he just helped hundreds of people. After 28 years of sobriety, his church told him that he wasn't entitled to a pension fund, and he drank. See, the resentment that came up in him triggered drink. There is no, as I see it, there is no magic cure for this thing. It's a day-at-a-time process. We're all on the same journey. We're all on the same road. I haven't been here longer, that's all. I have to work the same things you guys are working today, or my alcoholism will become active, and I will end up in bad shape. So this program for me is not something that I did or something that I can tell you about. It's something that I'm doing. Now, what has happened? It's the greatest thing in the world. I've been to places I never would have been accepted. I've even been accepted by Southerners, you know, and for them to accept a Yankee, that's, you know, wonderful thing, you know. And when they sent me down south, I got into steps. I got into this sort of thing, and it's been very good for me. So I've had a period of sobriety, and today I think I have a period of sobriety. I don't take myself too serious, and I try to stick in, you know, God's job is to judge people, and mine is to love them. And I don't just love people if they're sober. My job is to love them if they're drunk or sober. Now, I'll walk with them if they're sober, because they're going the same way I am. If a guy wants to go out drinking, God bless you, go. But I love you either way, because every time I get into judging, I get myself all upset and overwrought. So I want to thank you so much that I was asked to participate tonight, because AA is my life. It's given me something that I never would have had. It's given me a knowledge of Bill Roop, a child of God that's loved by his fellow man, and a person who loves himself. In closing, I'd like to close with something that I use sometimes when I talk. It's that Alcoholics Anonymous won't open the gates of heaven and let you in, but it'll sure open the gates of hell and let you out. It's up to you. Do you want to stay out and have a heavenly day? You're going to have to follow the principles and not drink. Now, you can stay sober and not follow the principle, and you can have a hell of a day. And it's really your choice. You're the one calling the shots. But whatever you're doing, if you're not drinking, remember that. You're a winner. Thank you very much.
My sponsor, Bill Hollingsworth from Roanoke, Virginia.
Well, I'm Bill Hollingsworth. I'm an alcoholic. And I believe alcoholism is a disease. And I think when I found out that it was a disease, it lifted that stigma that had been hanging around my neck for so many years that I was no longer that weakling, that no good bum, that I was sick. If I had been taking part in this program last night, I would have told you my little story that I recently heard about this sex and sobriety thing. It seemed that this Al-Anon was discussing her sex life with one of her Al-Anon friends, and she says, I closed my eyes when John and I are having sex. And his friend said, why do you close your eyes? She said, I don't want to see that son of a bitch enjoying nothing. that might have been one of them flashbacks that Ed was talking about. I never knew or ever heard about alcoholism or that I was an alcoholic. I had never heard that word. I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous until the last man that fired me told me the story of a man that I like to think of as was a walking copy of the big book up in Portland, Maine, who I don't know who he was. I don't guess I'll have any chance this late day of finding out. But he had lost everything, and the man who was telling me about it was a non-alcoholic. He was my boss, and he told me this remarkable story of this recovery that this man had made. And I thought, oh my, if I could just do that. But I didn't have any idea that I could, because I don't have any degrees. I never got out of high school. I was not in the Army. I was 30 years old when we had to register for the draft, and they had me up 3 or 4 times living up in North Carolina, and they had put me in 4F, and I'd always be so damn sick in the mornings when they'd have to go up for them re-examinations. They kept calling you up to see if you'd got out of 4F yet. They never had told me what I was in 4F for. But I'm sticking them needles in it. I never was a handling needles very well. And the doctor there that day, I had the courage to tell him, doctor, if they're going to take me in this army, please take me. Just don't keep calling me back up here. Because these guys like me just falling out in the floor, fainting and all that stuff. And I said, I'd just rather go than keep y'all calling me back up for these examinations. And he said, son, I'll fix that. He said, Hitler will be in Wilmington before we'll ever need you. That runs 200 miles down the road. I had 9 more years to drink after that, so I was in bad shape. I loved what booze did for me. There's very few people here in my generation, but I started drinking when it was illegal. It was illegal to drink. It was illegal to buy it. This was either indoors or outdoors. I heard about it, and I heard people talk about what good times they had with it, and I tried it, and my first experience with it was very bad. But I wanted, the second time I drank, it was something different. I think if I had not been an alcoholic after my first experience, that I would have never drank again, because it almost was a disaster. But the come on was that I loved the feeling I got from it. I liked the good music. I was romantic. I loved the gals, and I've often said that a half-gallon jar of that moonshine and a rumble seat and a full moon and a good-looking girl in Georgia. Boy, that's big. And I loved it. And I pursued it. But it was a problem. I got fired the first time before I was 18 years old, and this was a pattern of my life. And for several years, a little over 20 years. We know that the disease of alcoholism is progressive. I expect that is about all we really do know about it. It always gets worse. It's baffling, it's cunning, it's powerful. It destroys people. It almost destroyed me. But for some reason, and I found out that part of this disease is that insane, insidious compulsion that the alcoholic has to drink that we have no control over. And I drank many times in my life when I knew that I shouldn't, that I should be sober, but for some reason I could not refuse a drink. I didn't know it at the time, but I couldn't live with any peace of mind with the things that was happening to me inside. But a drink would change things, and I could feel better. I'm going to tell you a story that I led this many years ago, and every once in a while I'd get these many people together and I'll tell it. I don't think I told it in 2 or 3 years, but I read it in the paper somewhere. I don't know about any of y'all. Did people ever tell you this stuff's killing you? Don't you know it's killing you, Bill? Hell yeah, I know it was killing me. They really didn't know as sick as I was. Nearly dead then, you know. I heard that so much. It's killing you. And my story concerns an old drunk. He'd heard all of that too. It's killing you. And the priest had talked to him about it. Everybody, the doctor. One morning he was very hungover and he got on the bus going to work. In the very next corner, the parish priest got on and came in and sat down in the seat with him. And he had one hell of a hangover that morning. Breath about that long. And he was trying to hide behind the newspaper reading, you know. He knew he was going to have to say something to the father. And he said, Father, what causes arthritis? And the priest just knew this is the time to let this town know what causes arthritis. He said, I'll tell you what causes arthritis. Drinking liquor. Running around with these wild women. Laying out all night. Shooting crap. Said, how long have you had it? Said, I ain't got it. I'm reading you the Pope has. Well, that story is at least 30 years old, so it's been around. But I think it's the greatest story I ever heard. Due to the fact I'd been told that, my mother said, don't you know it's killing you? Yes, Mama, I know that. Well, I had really never tried to quit drinking, but I tried all the way that I'd ever heard of to drink. And, of course, I couldn't. And I really don't. This generation now, you know, I never bought a mixed drink in my life. If somebody said, Bill, mix me a martini, I wouldn't know what the hell to put in it. I knew nothing about that kind of drinking. The kind of drinking we did back in those days, I think it was Tuesday night, we'd get those jars of whiskey, and you know, one of the favorite places to go was the cemetery. Ain't nobody buy you that. Is he legal? There was a place up there in Macon up there on Coleman Hill, and they had a a water fountain, and we'd go up there and drink out of half-gallon jars of liquor. And thought this was just great living, just great. The wonderful fellowship that came as a result of this. Of course, it got worse and worse and worse. And I was a running drunk. And I didn't have sense enough to know that in this running from one place to another, that I was trying to do an impossible thing, to run away from myself. Because I always showed up. It was always the same. Somewhere nearby, right here in one of these little towns tonight, there's a bunch of drunks sitting around somewhere, like I used to be, talking about how bad things are. How bad they are here in Madison or Atlanta or whatever, city government bad, a bunch of thieves down there on the city council, and the taxes and their rates is high, and they don't pay minimum wage, and they go girls, they got them shut out, and we couldn't drink, it was a closed town, and they wouldn't let you gamble, wouldn't let you play poker. But some clown would speak up over there, you know, and he said, "Man, Birmingham, say you can drink on the job, the go-go girls are going," and he tried to open whole houses, and they pay above minimum, and if you don't feel like going to work, it just sounds so good. I'd be out there on the road the next morning going to Birmingham. You need to get to Birmingham, and there'd be a sounding bunch sitting around there telling you how bad it was in Birmingham. And you'd say, "Well, I heard, you know, it's different. I heard about it. Oh, it used to be," they said, "but no more." But Jacksonville is... I just left Jacksonville, and it's I just had something up because all that good in Jacksonville, why'd the son of a bitch leave there? But I had there, you know, and it was a rat race. I had some real times that I thought was good times. I had some good jobs. The only thing was that when you got fired from one of the good ones or whatnot, the remorse and was worse, and I never had any peace of mind. I never had any serenity in my life all those years. And the only time that there was any a feeling of belonging or anything was at first drink. And then, of course, it got to where there was only one drink of the day that was worth the damn, and that was the first one in the morning, because you knew from then on it was just a drink to live. And I know about the shakes, and I know about being out there without a place to stay. I even know what it's like to not own a pair of shoes. There are not many people, even through God's grace, that are directed here and have had the privilege and the longevity of sobriety that I've had. So, you know, nothing that I could take any credit for. Not one thing in this world. Because you see, I came here and I went to my first meeting, the first Tuesday night, in October of 1949. I was 38 years old, and I believe that I was possibly the youngest member of that group. The men who were there were men that had been to all kind of institutions, the key to cures, been in and out of jails and institutions. And this was what we were made up of. My sponsor, the man who brought me the message, was a man that had never been fired. He had been with his company all these years. And I found out that alcohol was no respecter of people. If we had the allergy to the first drink, it set up that craving for another drink, and that's all I had ever known about. I never had wanted one drink in my life. We never thought about taking one drink. When we bought those half-gallon jars or whatever we bought it to drink it then and get another one as soon as that went out. I have always felt that I didn't get here because of circumstances or luck or by chance, or that I deserve to be here, that I've gone down the ladder further than somebody else. And never has that ever occurred to me. I knew there was some special reason that I was here, because there were too many people still out there that were in institutions and that were dying as a result of this disease, destroying themselves through suicide. Many of them were in penitentiaries for life for crimes that they had committed under the influence. Many of them with wet brains. And I learned what for the grace of God meant. But for the grace of God, I am here and not in one of those places. That I was divinely guided into this fellowship that saves people's lives. And if we do these things, provides a new way of life. The attraction of the new way of life. Now, I never resisted anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I had certainly thought that I was inferior. I first heard about it being an inferiority complex until I mentioned it in a meeting or sitting in the club one night. And we had and he was from Atlanta, a Boston Irishman that traveled the territory and stayed in Charlotte. And I said something about having an inferiority complex, and Vic said, "Oh, no, Bill, you didn't have no inferiority complex. You was inferior." I didn't feel that I was as good as other people, really, because it had beaten the living hell out of me. And the greatest news I ever heard was the man told me we can stay sober one day at a time. That had never occurred to me, to try to not drink for one day. There were days when I couldn't get a drink. But the communication was there when he told me one day at a time. And I started the next day doing what he said that he had been doing for over 3 years. Now, Dave, if he can live until May, he will have 39 sober years. And Alcoholics Anonymous was the man who brought me the message. And he said that he asked for help from God as he understood him in the mornings, just for one day. And that night, he thanked that same God. And it's been that simple for me. I think one of the great statements that was ever made was by Dr. Bob Smith, "For God's sake, let's keep it simple." And I get it. I'm involved with all of these complicated things. The simplicity of, I was a wreck when I got here. But recognize that I was powerless, and asking for help just for one day, and then coming to realize with just a little faith there, with 3 weeks sobriety, that maybe that it would work for me. And I began to learn from people. Bill mentioned it. Really, that's where the message is, in people. I stayed sober over 17 years, and I had no idea really what was printed in the big book as far as reading it in print. But we had been practicing what was in there. So it's in people where we find strength that God, through people, I will say, that He provides this strength, this hope that we find here in our hearts and minds. It's the faith, the willingness, something that was all foreign to all of us, I suppose, is when we got here, to be willing to follow in the footsteps of those who've gone before. And it does not fail. I just wish, Billy, I tell you, the last time I heard him talk, I got so cracked up with him, like I almost did tonight. But I wish he would have told you about, I never had any experience with pills, but this has always remained in my mind. Doc said something about the horses. Billy said he had a horse and the damn horse was standing on his foot and said it hurt like hell. But see, he didn't give a damn. It was full of them pills. And I hurt, but I could take a drink. And really, we're all miracles that are here tonight in this room and in rooms throughout the world. And this fellowship is growing by leaps and bounds. I doubt there was this many people in AA in the state of North Carolina when I came in. Might have been. If you never got them all together in a place like, in one meeting place like this. So friends, if you're new here and you're getting started into this new way of life, keep it simple. It works. And the only difference in you who are sitting out there tonight with 35 days and me with my 35 years, you have all the good living ahead of you. The good living that I've experienced is coming your way if you do these things and follow these steps. And I thank you.